The Tom Woods Show, episode 2249.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, all you old timers out there from the Ron Paul 2008 campaign, you may remember my friend Larry Lepard, who spent $200,000 of his own money on full-page newspaper ads in support of Dr. Paul. Well, Larry has had an uncanny way with money over the years, and he made a presentation to my paid membership on how to insure yourself against currency debasement. That is to say, how to survive inflation. Well, I took that presentation out from behind the paywall, and I'm making it available to the general public for free. Check it out at tomwoods.com/Larry. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Delighted to have Chris Coyne back with us. He teaches economics at George Mason University, and he's got another book out. Productive fellow, this Chris Coyne. And this one is In Search of Monsters to Destroy, The Folly of American Empire and the Paths to Peace. Welcome back, Chris.
Well, thank you for having me again, Tom.
I love the way the Independent Institute formats its books, where you're trying to start reading the book, and it's just page after page after page of testimonials. I love that. Absolutely love it. You got some outstanding testimonials for this book.
Yeah. I was very fortunate that it has received a lot of interest. And I think one of the reasons why is, given the topic and the nature of the issues, it reaches a lot of people from a lot of different ideological perspectives.
Well, I'm sure at some point we talked about your book, Tyranny Comes Home, The Domestic Fate of U.S. Militarism. So you're not new to these kinds of topics by any means. This one uses the word empire quite liberally. And there are some people in probably the whole American establishment would take offense at the use of the word empire. And they would say, the United States does not resemble the empires of the past. We're not directly controlling everything that happens with subordinate peoples or anything like that. So how do you justify the use of that word empire?
Yeah, so you raise an excellent point, which is both among people in policy, but also even among academics, there's a debate about what constitutes an empire and if America is an empire. To my way of thinking, it's certainly the case that America is a unique type of empire in the history of empires, and that it is not explicitly involved in direct territorial acquisition, as many empires are. That said, the American government is actively involved in projecting its military power and force around the entire planet. And while it doesn't directly acquire physical land, what it does do is project that influence to control people around the world and control governments. And so that's the sense I'm using it. And there are proponents of the use of the term empire on both sides of the ideological aisle. So you have people like Neil Ferguson or Deepak Lal, who oftentimes refer to themselves as classical liberals, who write books called In Praise of Empire and talk about how America is an empire and that's good for the world because it provides order, public goods, and so on. And so just given the nature and the expansive nature of the American military apparatus around the world, I think the term is fitting.
It's interesting you say that, because I never forgot in the early 1990s, well, maybe I guess I forgot one detail. I can't remember if it was National Review or the Weekly Standard. But you know that historian Paul Johnson? I mean, he was enormously productive. He produced just massive tomes on a variety of topics.
Sure.
And yet, after all that, after having that level of knowledge of history, nevertheless, the cover story of whichever one of those magazines it was in the early 1990s from Paul Johnson was, "What the World Needs Now, Western Imperialism." So he embraced it. He didn't run away from the term. He embraced it, and he thought of himself as being somebody within the so-called classical liberal tradition. We're going to take our liberal ideas and try and bring them around the world. And that leads to another question. There are plenty of people who will say, yes, I totally hear you that the U.S. government has done things that morally there's no way you can support, but somebody's got to run the world. Like somebody, there has to be some power in charge. And if it's not the United States, I guarantee you, whoever substitutes for the United States will be far less benign in its operation of empire. What do you think about that?
Well, there's many possible responses, but I'll briefly highlight two. The first, that even if that is true, that other competing forces may arise to fill a gap if America pulled back, if not altogether removed itself from imperialistic activities abroad, you can still make the argument that if you hold liberal values, and I'm using liberal here in the classical sense of the term, not the modern ideological sense, that two wrongs don't make a right, to put it simply, meaning that if engaging in empire and imperialism is inherently illiberal, which I believe it is, and that's the argument I make in the book, then saying that, well, other people might do bad things isn't necessarily justification that you should, because in doing that, you might be eroding the very values you purport to uphold dearly, both domestically and internationally. The second response is to take issue, which I do, with the premise of the thought experiment you laid out, which you are correct that many people hold, which is, I don't think that one single party or group of people, an organization, needs to be in charge, needs to control society, let alone the world, which is what that type of reasoning assumes. And I think, like in a lot of other areas of life, so even if you think about economic activity within a society, let alone globally, attempts to impose order and control do just the opposite. They produce chaos and oftentimes squalor. I place a much stronger emphasis on the ability of people kind of from the bottom up to coordinate, cooperate, figure out ways of navigating conflict, and in doing so, generating orders which are largely emergent, which can't be planned, and which we can't know ex ante. So no group of experts can know what order should be absent the process that generates that order. And if you take that perspective, then the idea that we need someone in charge or else it's going to be chaotic and a world of anarchy is not nearly as powerful as it seems on the face of it.
In the same way that the word empire, as you say, is sometimes embraced, positively embraced by people rather than being repelled by it, the same can be said for deep state, because on the one hand, you get some people saying, there's no such thing as the deep state. I notice you use the term deep state. You get some people saying, oh, that's some crazy conspiracy theory. There's no such thing as a deep state. But then I'm pretty sure the Washington Post or some major newspaper ran an op-ed with a headline not a million miles away from, yes, there's a deep state, and thank goodness. It's protecting you from a rogue actor like a Donald Trump or something like that. So how do you describe this deep state, and how do you respond to people who say it's just in your imagination?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I do embrace the term. I think it has a very clear and straightforward meaning and dynamic behind it, which is simply, from my perspective as an economist, the economics of politics. And so we have elected officials in a democratic system, and then we have a significant number of bureaucrats, so unelected government officials who are not directly tied to some electoral outcome. They can be appointed by elected officials or by other bureaucrats, but they are insulated from direct electoral accountability. Whether that's good or bad is another question, which I'll come back to in a moment. So what happens? Well, as any bureaucracy gets larger and larger, it doesn't have to be the military sector, but there are unique features about that, which I'll return to. As any bureaucracy becomes larger and larger, you're going to have more and more bureaucrats, and it's going to be more and more difficult for even those within the bureaucratic hierarchy to monitor, to control those individuals, let alone members of Congress through congressional oversight and so on. And the military sector is unique because it is masked in secrecy. There is an entire apparatus that is put in place to keep information hidden, typically under the guise of national security and protecting national security secrets. But of course, it's become so expansive that people can simply hide information both from the public and from congressional oversight. And that's the deep state. If people want a very straightforward application of this to read more on, you mentioned the Washington Post. There's a journalist, I don't know if she's still with the Washington Post, Dana Priest. And years ago, she did an investigative piece called Top Secret America. This was after 9/11. I don't know if it was 5 years or 10 years after. And she and her co-author, I believe his name's William Arkin, tried to map out all of the people that had security clearance in the United States. So members of the bureaucracy, but also private contractors, which just ballooned in enormous fashion in the wake of 9/11 with the injection of funds into the security state in the name of the war on terror. And they couldn't do it. and they published this as a book, and you read through this book and you just realize how massive this apparatus is, but that how no one even knows what exactly it includes and what delineates it. And so that's the nature of the beast. Now, in terms of this being good or bad, again, it depends on where you come down on it and really the weight you put on concentrated political power, I should say, without clear accountability mechanisms. As you can imagine, I'm quite skeptical of that. But it might very well protect us from some rogue politician. Another line of argumentation I've heard as well, it's kind of the Jack Nicholson line in A Few Good Men, you can't handle the truth. And the ordinary citizens can't handle the truth about the brutality of the world and all the threats that are out there. And so we need this small group of elites who are rough and toughened and can look out for the greater good. And they need that discretionary, unconstrained power in order to protect us. But to my way of thinking, this is a terrible way of organizing society because it assumes, of course, that the people that are running this apparatus and wielding control over enormous power, surveillance, weapons, including nuclear weapons and so on, are somehow good, somehow enlightened, somehow will only use this apparatus for the public good, whatever that means. And I think we have very little evidence of that. I think we have very little evidence from the information that we can glean publicly. That is, if you look at many of the activities that the Pentagon undertakes, very quickly you realize that most of them have nothing at all to do with national security or public good in the traditional economic sense of the term. It is lining the pockets of a select few. And then, of course, we have lots of evidence from whistleblowers, going back to Daniel Ellsberg, Edward Snowden, and so on, who revealed or have revealed that this massive apparatus is oftentimes used to further the interests and visions of a small group of elite at odds with the very people that they claim to be protecting. And so when I review this evidence in its totality, along with just thinking about the industrial organization of a massive bureaucratic apparatus, I'm highly skeptical of those arguments that somehow it's good that this massive apparatus is insulated from political control, whether it's congressional oversight or executive oversight, let alone the public more broadly, which is, I think, the most important check.
All right, excellent. I appreciate all that. I was very happy to note, by the way, as I was reading, I thought, boy, this point he's making sounds like it's taken from Seymour Melman. And I looked in your notes, and sure enough, Seymour Melman. So Seymour Melman was an interesting guy. I actually wrote a paper on him that was published a long time ago, back when we still had the Journal of Libertarian Studies. And it was interesting because, without a doubt, he's on the left, but he was interested in the idea of opportunity cost when it came to the military state. And again, this has been so many years, but I somehow got into contact with people who were like scholars who were kind of carrying on the work of Melman. And I sent them my paper. And of course, my paper talked about Bastiat. I mean, why wouldn't you in a context like that of what is seen and what is not seen? And they came back and said, we had never heard of this Bastiat or that essay, but we absolutely love it. And we're glad that you're promoting his work, even if it's to a different audience. So can you say something about exactly how, in a way, it's like a crowding out effect or a seen and unseen effect of what, let's say, an oversized military state does?
Yeah. And so listeners should read your paper. I think it was 2010. It came out around there and it's wonderful. And
thank you.
It really lays out Melman's vision and research and connects it with both Bastiat, but if I remember correctly, Austrian economics more broadly.
Yes.
In a wonderful way. And interestingly, Melman was very left-leaning ideologically. And as you point out in your paper on, if I remember, I hope I'm attributing this to you correctly, that even though he came at these issues from a different ideological perspective, there's a lot of overlap in terms of the analytical logistics that people in kind of the Austrian tradition would point to. So what's going on here? Well, what Melman pointed out, and as you correctly noted, Bastiat prior and Henry Hazlitt, of course, is, look, there's always a trade-off with scarce resources. And when it comes to matters of the military and military spending, oftentimes this gets forgotten, even among extremely well-trained economists. And part of the reason why is because they're so trapped in the straitjacket of Paul Samuelson and the idea of, well, there's these things we call public goods, which have a very technical definition in economics, but the gist of it is that private people left up to their own devices will fail to provide public goods in sufficient quantities and qualities, and government needs to fill the gap. And going back to Samuelson, Paul Samuelson, in the mid-1950s, when he laid out and formalized this theory, he uses national defense as an example. And this is the textbook example. If you open any principles or intermediate or public finance textbook, you'll find national defense. And economists just kind of say it and stop there. And the minute you just say it and stop there, it assumes that government can provide this in optimal quantities and qualities, but also that it can maximize social welfare. So when it extracts resources from the private sector, which it needs to do in order to operate, since the government doesn't generate any revenue through for-profit activity like a private firm does, it raises it through the extraction of resources either in the immediate term or in the longer term through the issuance of debt, then you have to start thinking about what the trade-off is. And once you start thinking about it, it's kind of common sense. A drone is not a loaf of bread. And so if you spend money, if government pulls money out of the private sector in order to buy the drone, that money has to come from somewhere. And that has to come ultimately from the pockets of private citizens. And why is this problematic? Well, for several reasons. One is, at the moment of decision, there is no way for the political decision maker to judge the economic trade-off, which only can happen through markets. This is part of the broader calculation argument that, of course, Mises laid out, and then Hayek followed up on Mises or built off Mises in a variety of directions. So that's one. So there's no way for the planner to judge the opportunity cost, but it also has corrosive effects on the dynamism of markets. Because, as you put it, you crowd out private spending, which is Bastiat's point. The money just doesn't magically sit there or fall from on high. It would have been spent on something else. That something else influences a whole chain of economic activity, what we call the broader capital structure of production. And so even the smallest transfer of resources into the military sector, and of course, these transfers are not small, they're enormous, have ripple effects. The other thing it does, of course, is it redirects entrepreneurial alertness. So entrepreneurs, whether they are everything from, because again, people think about the military sector, they think about Boeing or Lockheed Martin, they think about Raytheon, bombs and guns, and that's true. But the military sector has tentacles that touch almost every sector in the American economy. The Pentagon is the country's largest employer. And if you think about it, in order to run this apparatus, you need IT firms, you need healthcare providers, you need accounting firms, you need paper suppliers, office supplies. Government contracts start going everywhere. That influences private behavior and redirects entrepreneurial alertness away from satiating the wants of private consumers to satiating the wants of political consumers. And that is the way I understand or think about the broader ripple effects. Melman was wonderful, but you know, he also believed in the need for a military structure. He just, I think he calls it overkill, is what he refers to, the amount above what is necessary in order to sufficiently provide defense. I'm skeptical that we can determine what that line exactly is where you move from value added to overkill. But
well, I think his thing specifically, when he would talk about nuclear weapons, it was that the amount that you have above and beyond, like once you have the capacity to completely destroy the enemy, if you're then adding the ability to destroy them three times over, the extra two times would be overkill.
Certainly, and that certainly would be wasteful in itself. I think the overkill is even greater in that situation, but yeah.
Probably so.
Yep.
Yeah, probably so. Hey folks, quick sponsor message from Blinkist. Can you imagine every single day driving in your car, you could do the equivalent of reading two or three books? Because Blinkist will summarize thousands and thousands of nonfiction books across dozens of categories so that you can get the main ideas, no fluff, no waste of your time, in 15 minutes. So we're talking about personal development books. You can build a skill or good habits by listening to the Blinkist summaries of these books, or works of history, or current events, or indeed libertarian classics by Murray Rothbard or Milton Friedman. You can get the key ideas injected straight into your brain. And how about this? Their brand new feature, Blinkist Connect, allows all premium users to share their account with another person of your choice. So it's two premium accounts, essentially, for the price of one. There's no extra cost for using it. So you can share these summaries with just one click, and you can add your comments and thoughts and generate a discussion back and forth. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your 7-day free trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. And now for a limited time, you can even use Blinkist Connect to share your premium account. You'll get 2 premium subscriptions for the price of 1. In particular, I remember with Melman, well, then we'll leave Melman alone, but one thing that really struck me was his point about research and development, that a lot of the research and development talent, the people who have the brains to do it, will get absorbed by the military apparatus. And he says, it's important for us to understand, it's not like if all these people go into the military and 1/3, let's say, of all your research and development talent is siphoned off into the military, it's not like substitutes are just going to pop up. Like all of a sudden, a bunch more geniuses will just come out of somewhere. There's a fixed number of these people. And so therefore, that means that there isn't research and development being done to develop products that would make the average person's standard of living better. So the research and development statistics were quite interesting to me. What I want to do, I want to hit a couple more quick things here with you, but I'd like to actually get you back on another time, maybe in the very near future. Because even though this is a very easy book to read in that you're taking sometimes difficult concepts, but you explain them really well, but also it's not that long, but yet I feel like this book has, in terms of real meat in it, vastly more than a lot of 400-page books I've read. Vastly more. There's no fluff. It's all just getting right to the point. So I might want to have you come back. But you have a section in here on what you call the domestic culture of militarism. And I've done a couple of episodes on this. I think you're describing a cultural phenomenon that goes beyond party lines, Democrat, Republican, certainly. They all, in one way or another, feed into this. What do you have in mind when you talk about our domestic culture of militarism?
Sure. So thank you for the kind words about the book. We tried to make it very streamlined and accessible to everyone. So I appreciate that. When I think about militarism, so let's start with that. The way I frame the concept is the elevation of the military apparatus above alternative ways of social organization domestically. So in plain English, the military kind of gets a special place. And in America, we see this all around us. And this then moves into the realm of how does this seep into our culture, which of course has a long history of the evolution of this. But even now, we take a lot of this for granted in terms of we're at sporting events and before almost every single professional and even college events as well, but certainly professional sporting events, there's oftentimes some kind of tribute to the military. There is some kind of parent coming home from abroad and surprising their families. There are awards giving out. There's flyovers. There's tributes to the military. We walk through the airport and people thank members of the military for their service, even though many of these people have never seen actual combat or been in a situation that is kind of would require that kind of praise. We go to the movies and people don't realize that the Department of Defense to this very day has a part of its broader apparatus is an entertainment division that works with producers and filmmakers in Hollywood and gives them access to military equipment in return for a say in the content of the script. So the most recent iteration of this, of course, is the recent Top Gun movie that came out. And it serves like as a major subsidy to these film companies who get access to this equipment and the military bases without having to incur the full cost. And so even going back to myself, and I realize it's one data point, but it does again make you realize if you start thinking about all the ways throughout your life, or certainly over the last several decades where this kind of logic existed. I remember being in grammar school during the first Gulf War. And of course, everyone had to wear yellow ribbons. That was the thing. And you tied yellow ribbons around the tree. And if you didn't do this, in your trees in your front yard, you were supposed to tie yellow ribbons, which the school provided to us. And if you didn't do this, it was somehow a sign that you were anti-America or not patriotic or against the troops. And these small little elements are everywhere. Then on top of that, of course, the big kind of very observable things are the massive apparatus that exists about 13 miles from where I'm sitting in Arlington, Virginia, the Pentagon, which is a massive physical building, but also massive in size. And that culture of militarism then permeates throughout society because not only is it held up as being a focal point of American society, a focal point of this is the country that's the bastion of freedom and liberty. And we have this massive Pentagon that protects freedom around the world. But as I was mentioning earlier, all of its activities kind of seep throughout life and become ingrained in it. And so when you start thinking in those terms and you start realizing the implications, you realize that part of what makes pushing back against this so hard is that from a very young age, people are steeped in this culture. They are indoctrinated into it. Whether that's purposeful or not is a different question. I think in reality, it's some combination of the two, meaning that I think governments take active steps to indoctrinate young people into that broader culture of militarism. All governments do it, even democracies, let alone authoritarian governments. But it's just part of the norms of society too. And those norms have been around for a long time, certainly going back to the two world wars and how the military was viewed then. And so that's kind of the gist and framing of how I think about the problem. And the nice thing is that as individuals, we have the agency to change that. We have the ability to change how we view the military apparatus. We have the ability to remove it from the pedestal on which it now sits.
It's interesting, though, that as people, for instance, came to acknowledge that maybe the 2003 Iraq war had been a mistake, the more we're seeing that military solutions to, well, in that case, there wasn't even a problem to solve, or if there was, the solution was completely misplaced going to war in Iraq. Well, at the very least, we can say that. But as people have kind of come to that conclusion, it's like the devotion to the military has only increased. If you were here as a European visitor and watching, I suppose, the Super Bowl or whatever, a lot of cultural events, so much of it has military overtones to it. It's just absolutely everywhere. And we're taught to say certain things to people who served in the military. But I think we all know that going over to Iraq in 2003 didn't, quote, make us safer. We kind of all know this. And yet we're still expected to go through this scripted scenario where we just tell people that we appreciate that they went and did that. I kind of wish they hadn't done that. It would have been better for them, would have been better for Iraq, would have been better for our pocketbooks. So I just can't go along with this. I'm not going to be rude to people, but I can't be part of this. I don't want to applaud when the plane lands and I find out that there's somebody in the military on the plane. I mean, there are a lot of people who have honorable professions we don't applaud for. I don't like the way that the military is singled out in this way. And in fact, it got to the point, my kids went to an absolutely outstanding private school years ago. But on Veterans Day, it was flag and military worship. So we just kept them home. I mean, what are we supposed to do?
Well, that's wonderful on your part. So I give you credit for that. But you're certainly right. And the question that rarely gets answered, and you touched upon this, and I agree with everything the way you put it, at these sporting events, for instance, not just the flyovers and these kind of reuniting of families, and it's teary-eyed, and the kids haven't seen their father or their mother for 6 months, sometimes a year, whatever their deployment was, and then they surprise them. Well, no one seems to ask, like, there is a way to avoid this, which is not to send people abroad into other countries, and then they can be home with their kids during that whole formative time period. And so that kind of captures the fundamental core of it. And in some sense, those small micro level things that kind of become normalized in life are almost more important in many ways than because people think like, oh, the Pentagon, or, you know, it's $1 trillion. What can I, the ordinary person, do about it? Well, there's a lot you can do about it in your own daily life. And I think you nicely touched upon a variety of ways that you can do that, both for yourself and for your kids and your family in general.
Well, as I say, I want to get you back and we'll do another, because there's a lot of material in here, and I want to do another episode with you, if that's okay. But in the meantime, I want to urge people to check out tomwoods.com/2249, our show notes page for today, because that's where I'll have linked your book, which, of course, is In Search of Monsters to Destroy, The Folly of American Empire and the Paths to Peace. Such a great book, a great summary. And what I have to say that I like about it, and I think this is probably true of most books that the Independent Institute publishes, I'm capable of, as Rothbard was, when the time calls for it, I'm capable of restraining my naturally sarcastic tone and over-the-top tone and just writing scientifically. But on the other hand, there are times when I just have to drop all that and just go for the jugular. And then Rothbard was the same way. You read Man, Economy, and State, it seems like a completely different person from the guy writing these columns later on. But you have that restraint, that scholarly restraint that is sometimes very important, especially with a controversial topic like this. You make it sound like common sense. It doesn't sound like the ravings of an ideologue. It sounds like the common sense conclusions of somebody who is really trying to look dispassionately at these issues. So that's very, very important. So check out In Search of Monsters to Destroy by our guest, Chris Coyne. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
All right, folks, that is another episode of the Tom Woods Show. I will see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.